So welcome to the Bioethics Colloquium. My name is Jonathan Moreno. I'm in the Center for Bioethics. And our speaker today, as you know, is Professor Nick Bostrom. I want to correct a social error I committed the last time I introduced a speaker at our colloquium when I said that the biopolitics students should get the first shot at questions. I forgot that the other class that meets at this time in our program is also here. So I want to say tonight, let's let any of our students ask the first questions after Nick has spoken, and I will let him field his own questions. I also want to point out that there's a list of courses in the spring program out there for people in the master's program or people who just want to give us a try. So a brief introduction for Nick. He, of all people, doesn't require much of a verbal introduction since he is so Googleable, and since I've been talking about him for the last few months. I said to Nick before, maybe we should just show his TED Talk, which if you haven't seen is on the web, and then he can comment on his own talk, which would, I think, be a nice 21st century approach, but we won't do it that way. So Nick is a University of Oxford professor known for his work on existential risk, which he talked about at lunch earlier today. He holds and other work as well, including transhumanism, issues around cloning, artificial intelligence, superintelligence, mind uploading, cryonics, nanotechnology, and the simulation argument, any of which he would be happy to tell you about, I'm sure. He has a PhD from the London School of Economics and is currently the director of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford. In 1998, Nick co-founded the World Transhumanist Association, which has since changed its name to Humanity Plus. In 2004, he co-founded the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and he currently serves as the chair of both organizations. In 2005, he was appointed director of the newly created Oxford Future of Humanity Institute after a 2.5-year stint at Yale. And he is, among his other honors, the 2009 recipient of the Eugene R. Gannon Award for the Continued Pursuit of Human Advancement, which we approve of here at Penn. So, Nick, it's really a pleasure to have you. It's a highlight of our semester, and we look forward to hearing you and to a discussion.
Thank you. That's very kind. So I'm going to try to think back to the day before PowerPoint existed, because I've had a big computer meltdown just before this talk. And we'll have to make use of the whiteboard. So apologies in advance if this is kind of a bit stuttering. The title of this talk that would have been displayed here would have been Transhumanism, a Critical Appraisal. So what I want to do is paint some sort of broad brush stroke history of the dialectic as I see it that has taken place up until the period where we are now in this big debate about enhancement, using technology to change human nature itself, perhaps. So just before we get into that, let me say a few words about terminology and trying to define these words. Transhumanism, it's important to understand, is not a specific, rigorously defined philosophical doctrine. It's not the case that some deep philosopher sat down one day and decided to coin this new term for a particular position that they had articulated. It's rather a label for a kind of cultural and intellectual movement that affirms the possibility and desirability of fundamentally improving the human condition through applied reason, especially by developing and making widely available technologies to eliminate aging and to greatly enhance human intellectual, physical, and psychological capacities. And so the definition is vague, and different people will develop different versions and flavors of transhumanism, and including some that are not defensible at all. So there certainly are a number of crackpots and others that would use any label like this. So I don't want to try to be in a deficient to defend everything that has been written under this rubric. I think one might get slightly more structured if one thinks of the transhumanist ambition as having a kind of top-level goal, which would be to give all people the opportunity to explore the post-human realm, if you want. And I'll say a few more words about what that term might mean, which would entail a number of sub-goals or prerequisites. So one would be safety from global catastrophes that could prevent humanity from surviving until the stage where these technologies can be developed. A second prerequisite would be technological progress, specifically progress on various kinds of human enhancement technologies. There are a lot of things that we might want to do, but that we just can't do yet. So unless those technologies are available, the dream will forever remain unrealized. A third prerequisite might not be a logical prerequisite, but in practical terms very important, is morphological freedom, the basic idea that, perhaps with various qualifications, individuals ought to be given, a lot of freedom about which enhancement technologies to use or not to use, how to shape their own bodies and minds. And obviously that could be a whole big discussion on exactly what the limitations on that would have to be. But transhumanists tend to place a lot of emphasis on this. A fourth prerequisite would be wide access. It would not be all that good if these technologies were developed, but only a few people actually were able to afford them, say. And finally, but very importantly as well, the wisdom and the social environment to use these new powers well. We get all of these powers made available, people have the right to use them, but they use them in foolish ways, the result will not be particularly salutary. The word posthuman, I think, perhaps creates more confusion than clarity, but nevertheless, it's in the discussion around, and it's used as a label, so one might perhaps have to live with it. I will take it to mean that posthuman is a being that has at least one posthuman capacity, where a posthuman capacity would be any general central capacity greatly exceeding the maximum attainable by any current human being without recourse to new technological means. Where a general central capacity would include health span, the capacity to remain healthy, active and productive, both mentally and physically, cognition, including both general cognitive capacities such as memory, deductive and analytical reasoning, attention, and also special faculties like the ability to appreciate music, humor, eroticism, narration, spirituality, mathematics, etc. Emotion might be another broad domain of general central capacities, and maybe there are others as well, but it would at least include those. So a posthuman being would be one that has at least one of these general central capacities to an extent that exceed what any current human could have without new technology. So much for definition. So I want to try to sketch a kind of timeline here, which has as its first phase roughly pre-1980 or so. And we can identify, broadly speaking, a sort of pro-enhancement side of the debate. Contrast side. So in this first phase, let's call it phase zero, basically the response from both sides was the same. There wasn't really a debate, and people on what would have been either side mainly ignored it. There are a few counterexamples to this, but there wasn't really very much serious, sustained attention and debate and discussion about the ethics of human enhancement technologies. You might think Brave New World, that some of you might have heard, is a counterexample, but if you actually look carefully, it's not the story of human enhancement technologies. But of human de-enhancement technologies. There are the people who are not harmed, and then there are various people with various degrees of engineered mental retardation. And so it's a very interesting book, but it's not really about enhancement. We then get to sort of the first phase, roughly from?
Well, maybe it goes on to 2000. Phase one. Where on the one hand we have a kind of non-academic transhumanism, and particularly Stropianism, which is a kind of flavor of transhumanism that was, you know, a lot of people talking about it back then. It's kind of faded away since. Stropianism is kind of transhumanism coupled with libertarian-leaning politics. And whereas transhumanism itself can be combined and has been combined with a wide variety of different political views. It doesn't in itself have any particular, you know, distinctive political implications. And on the other side, we have basically the argument that this is just science fiction. So the debate was between various, mostly non-academic types who were excited about these different prospects. There are people from interest in space colonization or chronics or ways to extend lifespan through caloric restriction and computers and nanotechnology. And these thought that there is some kind of common denominator here. You know, these technologies might have synergies and they might be used to change human nature and we might become post-human, and all of this is very exciting. And then the mainstream community, mainly if they paid any attention at all, would say that, well, you know, this is all very fun, but it's, you know, it's not really worth taking seriously. And there would be debate about this. I think that the argument here has been settled towards the pro side. I mean, basically, there are a number of answers that can be given to this charge that it's just silly and not worth taking seriously. One is, of course, that there is an increasing number of examples of enhancements in both animals and humans. We have sport enhancement, sexual enhancements, we have cognitive enhancements. In animals, you obviously can see more extreme results because it's easier to do experiments. That helps to move it from the realm of science fiction into the realm of the actual. We can see apparent progress towards a number of potentially transformative technologies that are such that if and when they are developed would certainly make possible profound transformations of the human condition in artificial intelligence, machine-faced nanotechnology, whole brain emulation, anti-aging medicine, cognitive enhancements more than we have, various ways of intervening to change mood, energy, personality, genetic engineering. So there are these kind of things on the horizon that a lot of people take seriously that, if they happen, would certainly enable, you know, significant enhancement. A third reason for taking it seriously is that since the consequences of being able to change not just the world around us, but change human nature itself would be very profound, it would be worth taking this seriously, even if one thought that the probability of it happening anytime soon was very small. And finally, we might consider, if we step back, what we might call macro patterns of the human condition. So if I pull up another slide in my PowerPoint over here, if we sort of plot on one axis technological development, or the level of capacity available. This is a very schematic rather than a graph where the exact shape would matter. And here, time. Suppose that this is now. Then we could distinguish roughly sort of three levels. We have some kind of pre-human level, which is where, you know, the state of the Earth was until very recently. Then we have now a kind of human condition. This would be like a human condition, and we might imagine at least some post-human condition. So the question is, what happens after this? One type of future scenario is that the developments that we've seen recently level off, so that we'll have some kind of continuation like this that stays forever within the human realm. What gives one doubt is that if one plots, say, the best metric we have of technological capacity, rather than looking at specific technologies, you want to sort of integrate all of that, you can look at economic productivity, global economic productivity as a kind of proxy measure for humanity's ability to mobilize resources in environments to produce things that we value. What you find is something that doesn't look like a kind of stagnating curve at all, but depending on what time scale you draw it over, you see there an exponential. So if you go back 100 years or so, if you go back further than that, you see something that is hyper-exponential. If you imagine plotting this kind of curve going back 10,000 years ago, you basically see exponential of an exponential. If you go back 200,000 years ago, they didn't have any money then, but you could still approximate world product by thinking that you know roughly what the size of the population was, and these people were mainly living at the subsistence level. You can calculate, you know, how much resources it takes to keep one human hunter-gatherer alive. Then, if this is 200,000 years ago, you basically get a curve that looks like this, where this is now. On that scale, that's really how it looks. So, of course, it's possible that if this is where we're currently going, that very close to now we will just plateau on each one of these, but it would require a radical discontinuity. And one might think that that is sort of prima facie impossible. And another type of scenario would be that, well, maybe maybe things growth continues for a while, and then maybe there is a catastrophe. Say we don't go extinct, though, maybe we recover after some period of time, and then maybe there's another one. And you could imagine a kind of oscillating pattern for human civilization, which would avoid the implausibility of thinking that things just suddenly sort of going to a halt and remain static forever. But again, there are a couple of difficulties with this scenario. One is that you have to ask yourself what kind of catastrophe would be able to bring this about. It would have to be calibrated such that it would really collapse our ability, but not be so severe as to cause human extinction. And then the next time around, when we got to the same level, the same thing would have to happen again. And if you think about this from a longer time period, you would have to have this oscillation happening indefinitely. The longer you extrapolate it, the more likely it's that you break out of this pattern, either down or up. And so one scenario, obviously, is the scenario in which the human saga ends. Perhaps we develop some very powerful technology and we use it to destroy ourselves. That's the existential risk. And I think that should be taken seriously. And the remaining type of scenario is either go up quickly or maybe over a period of time reach into this realm where we have the capability of creating post-humans.
So together with the other reasons that I mentioned, I think that it's not, at least today, a wise stance to say that it's silly and just science fiction. And that then moves us into a new phase of this debate, phase two, which I guess would go from 2000 until, it's still going, so let's put 2009 there. And this is what we might call, on the pro side, bioethics transhumanism. So a number of things have happened in this transition. One is that, first of all, extropianism is more or less gone. So there are now sort of social democratic flavors of transhumanism and middle of the road
transhumanisms and a political one. And the second is that it's become a lot more academic. So bioethicists have got involving themselves in this area over the last decade, publishing in academic journals and writing books and discussing at academic seminars, and giving it a lot more rigor than it received previously. And on the other side, we have had mainly the argument, obviously one has to oversimplify a great deal to compress it into a table, but the bioconservative critique. Sorry for my handwriting, it's an ability that has completely atrophied. And at the basic level, it seems to amount to the claim that the goal is not worth attaining. And that kind of comes in two versions. One version of this is that even the best post-human lives would be worse than human life. At least worse than relatively good human lives. If we imagine the human condition cured of its worst flaws, extreme poverty and some diseases, then becoming post-human would just somehow undermine what is truly valuable about human nature, dehumanize us. This is kind of the line carried by Leon Cass and his President's Council. There's another possible version of this is that although some post-human lives would be at least as worthwhile, more worthwhile than human lives, we would not have reason to pursue it. We couldn't benefit. So one way of thinking about this is that, take the extreme case. Suppose there was some post-human life that was more worthwhile than us, and if this room was just swept clean, we were all killed, and then instead there were other people now planted on all of these seats, it wouldn't have benefited us, even if in some impersonal way that would now perhaps be more worthwhile lives being lived. And you can imagine similarly with profound transformations that what come out at the other end would be something really nice, but just wouldn't be us any longer. So this kind of person-affecting reason might, again, mitigate against the transhumanist project. So if we take the first of these claims first, that even the best post-human lives would be worse than human lives, there are a couple of ways to argue against this. One is to try to create visions that generate intuition. So if you could paint a vivid picture of what a post-human life could be like, it might have such appeal that you would contemplate it and you compare it with what human life is like, and you might sort of judge after that the post-human life could be much better. And I think there is some limited mileage in this, but it's hard to create really concrete images of what living as a post-human would be. Almost by definition, if you take cognitive enhancements, it's very difficult for a chimpanzee to think what it would be like to be human. It might be equally difficult for us to think of what it would be like to be post-human. New emotions and levels of emotional well-being might similarly be difficult to access. We might be able to think what it would be like to live much longer. And again, we have to be careful in such a scenario to control for various confounders, like the fact that right now, when people get older, they tend to get frailer and sicker. You'd have to imagine a scenario where aging was not associated with decrepitude. And you would also have to think about what kind of social context would this happen in. It's one thing if it changed how we humans are, but left society intact, and there would be a mismatch. To create an attractive scenario, you would have to envisage a whole new culture and society that would fit these new post-human beings as well. So generating sort of vivid descriptions is hard. That would make this
attractive. But perhaps with enough creative ingenuity, you could do it. Another argumentative strand would be to try to check these different situations and sort of rate them by looking at current popular theories of well-being, theories about what human flourishing consists in, what the good life consists in. And there are a number of different ones on the table. So if you're a hedonist, to take a simple case, you think that a good life is one that has a greater predominance of pleasure over pain. Let's say the crudest version of that. Then you can think, well, with post-human capabilities, in the best case scenario, could there be a lot more surplus of pleasure over pain than we currently have? And the answer clearly could be yes, if you could manipulate the parts of our brains, say, that experience pleasure, then you could presumably reach much greater levels of pleasure. So then, if you're not a hedonist, you don't have to think about some other theory. So maybe you have some view that what's a good human life is one that, you know, involves deep, meaningful relationships and, you know, objectively worthwhile achievement combined with enjoyment and appreciation of beauty or something like that. Then you could see whether on each of these ingredients and the combination of them, you would be able to satisfy them to a higher degree with post-human capabilities used optimally than you could with just our current level of capabilities. And I think that there are many different theories of well-being in which the answer would clearly be yes. But you'd have to go through them, and there might be some theories of well-being, although it's hard to think of any plausible one that would entail that it would not be possible to have much greater levels of human flourishing than we can currently access. Thirdly, you could invoke a kind of best judge argument. So John Stuart Mill hit upon this idea of using as an argument for a particular ethical theory what the people best placed to judge between, you know, in this case, the relative the value of different goods, say lower pleasures versus higher enjoyments. And he thought that people who could experience both were the best placed judges. So a wise man could appreciate the, you know, the pleasures of great music and the physical pleasures that might be similar to the pleasures that the pig has, whereas the pig could only appreciate one. And so we could see the best placed judges would be one that could judge both, and we should listen to them, and that's kind of an argument for one theory of well-being over another. Now, who would be the best placed judges in the case of judging transhuman prospects? Well, this is difficult to say, but suppose we look at various particular capacities, lifespan to start with. You might think that old people might be a better judge. Say somebody who is 89 years old might be a better judge of whether living one extra life is worthwhile than somebody like living to 90 rather than 89 is worthwhile, rather than one a person who is 20 or 30, because the 89-year-old is much closer to sort of having experienced that extra life year. And if you do that, you find, I mean, so there's only limited quantity of data, but we do find that life satisfaction, contrary to widespread belief, is stable over the lifespan. There was one study done on really the oldest old living in a care home with average age sort of 90-something, and presumably they were in quite poor condition since they were in a care home. And they were asked about their preferences for different trade-offs between living, you know, 1 month shorter or 2 months shorter or X number of months shorter in return for having a much better remaining quality of life. So if they could be fully healthy, how much remaining life would they be willing to give up? And the median answer was something like 1 month, and much less than, for example, their caretakers assumed. So even if you have already lived a very long life and you are in a very poor condition, it turns out you're really not very willing to give up even a slight amount of extra lifespan, even in return for a great improvement in the quality of life. Similarly, you could think with cognition that people, say, who are very musically gifted might be better judges of the value of being
you know, slightly more musically gifted or being able to continue to exercise your musical capacities than people who have no musical talent. So you could then see if there is a pattern. Nobody has post-human musical powers, but some are closer to it than others. And does the value placed on musical ability decrease, increase, or stay constant as we move across different levels of musical ability? Let's call it musical ability. So how much value do you place on music at different levels of musical ability? I don't have any data on this at all, but it seems possible to me that if anything is increasing, it doesn't seem to be decreasing. So you might then think that if these people with higher musical ability are better judges of the value of high levels of musical ability, that that's kind of an argument for thinking that this relationship might continue, that musical ability is going to continue to be valuable even at levels beyond the current human range. And so you could try to construct these kind of best judge arguments with looking at people who are closest to these new levels of capacity that we're contemplating. And finally, in terms of arguments for rejecting the claim that even the best post-human lives would be worse than human lives, we can think about just how large this space of possible modes of being are. So if you think of some huge space of possible modes of being, where a mode of being would be a way of thinking, feeling, relating, doing. We think of the ones accessible to human beings as being a tiny little speck. So we can think, feel, be, and relate in all possible ways. We are limited by our biological constraints. The human brain can't think thoughts that don't fit into a 3-pound lump of cheesy gray matter. And similarly, we can't feel emotions that we don't have the neurological machinery to feel. We can't experience what it's like to live for 300 years because we're dead before that happens. So we can only explore all the human experience is located in a tiny little subset of this vast space. And since we are an animal, we are a subset of a slightly larger subspace of possible modes of being. So different animals can experience. We don't know what it's like to have sonar hearing, but other animals do. But we already know that within this little space, the human space of being, there are vastly valuable modes of being. You know, the best human lives can be really wonderful. But since this total space is so large, it would seem strange to assume that all the really good possible modes of being are in this tiny little fraction of it that we can access. You might think that there is a larger space of conceivable post-human modes of beings and an even larger one of not imaginable by human possible modes of beings, and that if only we could develop the tools that would enable us to explore this larger space, we would find some possible modes of beings there that would be extremely wonderful and worthwhile beyond what we have seen so far. And just the size of this larger space compared to this subspace that we have explored is some reason, I think, to reject this claim. As for the claim that we couldn't benefit, there are a number of reasons to doubt that. First, we can consider enhancements that strengthen autonomy, memory, personal continuity, and survival. So if the concern is that we would no longer exist at the end of this transformation process, well, then consider what is that has to be the case in order for us to still be there. So obviously, we'd still have to be alive rather than dead. Well, this is something that might not hold if we have human capacities. If we extend lifespan, it would seem that the prospect of survival would increase rather than decrease. If you think of psychological continuity, well, some enhancements might actually strengthen the connection between different life stages. So a stronger memory might increase the link rather than diminish it.
if you think autonomy and autonomous choice is the critical factor here, well, we humans pride ourselves as that, but we are quite limited in our ability to independently consider the options available to us and choose an informed way between them. You know, that's something that could be strengthened. Clearly, there are other possible enhancements that would make us weaken these links that bind different time slices together. But one could conceive of at least some processes of becoming post-human, it seems, that would only use the enhancements that would strengthen these and therefore wouldn't diminish our connection to these hypothetical future slices of ourselves. You could also, and this goes back to an analogy with the argument we mentioned against this claim, consider different specific theories about prudential reason, about what people have reason to do for themselves, and see how they would apply to this case. That's another type of argument. Then you could consider an analogy, I think an apt analogy, which is that we do undergo a kind of metamorphosis. If you think of the little toddlers that you once were and the adults that you now have become, the difference is pretty profound. I mean, in terms of the capacities you have, the cognitive capacity. You have a totally different mental life, a completely different level of emotional maturity. You have totally new emotions that the toddler didn't have, connected to, I don't know, romance and stuff like that. And we don't think it's a big tragedy and really bad that the child grows up. In fact, we think the contrary. It would be a tragedy if some child just stopped developing. And you might then wonder why we should think that it would be a tragedy if we continued to grow up, even though historically we have been unable to do so for biological reasons. So I've just sort of sketched some arguments for why we should reject these two claims. And why, hence, I think transhumanism is victorious in this phase too. And not all forms of transhumanism, but the best forms of transhumanism. The question here, though, and this goes back to the part of... So the title, as I said, was A Critical Appraisal of Transhumanism. So far, there has not been much critical. But the question is, where would we go from here in a kind of phase three? And this will be the last part of my talk. Well, first of all, I think that it would be ideal if this kind of dichotomy could be eliminated. I think it's kind of outlived its usefulness, this big, you know, divide of people on one side of this debate, sort of lobbying arguments against one another, and that there should be a different configuration with many different positions combining different, we might for some enhancements and against others, or only in various, on the various conditions you might favor the use of some ways of changing technology, not others. And so avoiding the polarity of this, I think, would be a step forward in the debate. I think now focusing on specifically on the current version of transhumanism, that there are a number of problematic features. One is what we might term the enhancement fixation. I think that the distinction between therapy and enhancement is analytically problematic. Once you start to look at more detail, it's not really clear how you would define enhancement such that it is interestingly different from therapy. And it might just not be very helpful if you think looking for ways to carve up the world in ways that enable us to think more clearly about it, that this distinction deserves a central place in that. Related to this, I think, is a tendency towards techno-hype. Again, this is not an essential part of transhumanism, but I think some proponents are guilty of this, of hype, feeling that they have to hype new technology in general, be in favor of and enthusiastic about new technologies, and perhaps also optimistic about how soon things will happen. I mean, these are completely logical, independent of anything I have said earlier, but they tend to be bundled up into this general sort of pro-technology stance.
I think also it's a boring argument, but that the concern with medical side effects of current and near future enhancement technologies is practically very important, and there is a tendency to underestimate this, I think, among some enthusiasts. But I think that's a big focus, actually getting something that could give you, not post-human, but even just 5% improvement without having some long-term hidden side effect. I think that would be a real advance. Second problematic feature of contemporary transhumanism is, I think, that it's short on specific, realistic, well-considered response options to, for example, address socioeconomic dimensions. It's, you know, not exactly an error, it's more an omission at this point. There just hasn't been any people around to have been able or had the time or ability to carefully articulate what such a general vision would boil down to in terms of particular policy proposals, say. And I think that there has often been a kind of cultural and spiritual superficiality in the sense of an underappreciation of, and it's hard to pinpoint this because you couldn't say, point to one particular place in some authoritative text that would prove that transhumanism has been culturally or superficial or spiritually superficial. But there is a tendency not to fully appreciate the rich dimensions of human culture and heritage that we are carrying forward and that we would need to be aware of and preserve going forward. Thirdly, I think another problematic feature of contemporary transhumanism has to do with questions of priority. Granted that there could be goods coming from enhancement, well, how do we weigh that against other contemporary needs, say in developing countries? So if even if your goal is cognitive improvement of cognitive ability, just to focus on one component, you could do a whole lot of good. You could save a lot of IQ points by promoting iodinization of salt in developing countries. And you could make a lot bigger and quicker gains there than by developing cognitive enhancing drugs. And there are some really low-hanging fruits there. The lack of iodine is one sort of big scandal that is still going on, and it costs the world a lot of IQ points. So there is the question, and this goes back to the enhancement fixation point, why this obsessive focus on enhancement when there are so many other ways of enhancing human capability, and they need other kinds of needs that need prioritization. And a big and open question, I think, about intergenerational trade-offs. I mean, this is not specific for transhumanism, but there is the general question of how much of our effort should be devoted to the future and future people that will inhabit this planet versus people who are here now. And transhumanists have not had much to say about that so far. And finally, and the last problematic feature of contemporary transhumanism that I want to bring up here is the complex interactions with existential risks from this transhumanist project. And this is twofold. So one, the unwise use of human modification technologies in itself could cause various kinds of existential disaster. You could imagine, if we end up in a kind of Brave New World scenario, the situation, that's one way for humanity to fail by many criteria, to realize, you know, its potential. And I think that there are real risks when we begin to change ourselves without, you know, having the kind of wisdom that would be required to do that well. Also, existential risks coming from various enabling technologies. So in addition from the enhancement application itself, if we're talking about machine intelligence, genetic engineering, nanotechnology, etc., a lot of these technologies have many applications, including some that are potentially very dangerous. And there is the not completely resolved issue of how does trying to promote these kinds of developments of enhancement technologies, what effect does that have on our total level of existential risk? Would it be better if we went slower? Or are there some particular types of enhancement technologies that we are just not ready for, that it would be too dangerous? Even if they're good in principle, if used well, there might just be excessive risks in trying to get there. Thank you.
So I'm going to exercise the power of the chair and ask the first question, then we'll go. So It is, our class has been looking at some bioconservative positions, and so I want to go back to the way that you framed the first objection to transhumanism or posthumanism, and I want to suggest that is one articulation of the bioconservative view, but there's another one, and of course, whenever you talk about a particular view, there are going to be different ways of phrasing the objection or the point of view. So the first one in particular that you addressed was that even the best post-human future would be worse than the human condition. Sometimes what people like Leon Kass suggest is that it's not a matter of better or worse, but that being human involves something like struggle or suffering, and that that in itself is a good, even though it often, in fact, maybe even the aggregate over a lifetime, is not experienced as a good. And maybe there's an element of redemptive suffering, perhaps, right, in that view. Now, of course, you could respond, well, but if struggle is important for human flourishing, then we can build that into a post-humanist lifestyle. The post-human would be have these opportunities to struggle and perhaps suffer, if they would, on the whole, improve what it is to be post-human, right?
Right.
But then, of course, the bioconservative could respond, well, but that's sort of question begging, right? Then what does it mean, really, to be post-human, if you build suffering and struggle in? You see what I mean? So how do you respond to that bioconservative critique, that struggle, suffering, knowing that you could fail? And not just in a virtual reality environment, not just in a, right, but in a real sense, fail, yeah, is important, even though it may mean we suffer more than we enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, so it comes down to a definition, whether you want to define a post-human as a being incapable of suffering or of failure. I would not choose that definition because I think it's not a very interesting one. It doesn't lend itself to the formulation of any plausible or interesting philosophical doctrine, and it doesn't serve a clear purpose. Certainly, I would, within this space of possible modes of beings, if we imagine post-human ones as being some vast extension of our current, I mean, that would include a lot of modes of beings that would, you know, perhaps have more suffering than the human condition, but bad ones, and struggle as well. So, in practice, that would be risk if you had all these capabilities without an understanding of what the various things are that are needed to make a worthwhile human life. You miss out one of. Suppose suffering struggle is one essential part of a worthwhile human life. But you forget about that when you design your post-humans. Well, then you will have ended up with an existential catastrophe in principle. But there is nothing in the definition or in my concept of a post-human which would preclude them having lives that involve struggle.
Gotcha. All right, so now you go ahead and make
it. Okay.
I don't understand how we can draw one line on that chart and say, here's human and here's post-human. And
in which chart?
The first one you drew with the time versus...
this?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, couldn't we already be post-human? Like, haven't there been developments that said that post-human means increase in health span, and we've had that, and increase in cognition, and maybe we've had that through teaching and kind of cumulative knowledge. So,
I mean, this again comes down, and I mean, your question will illustrate this as well, why the word post-human is not very helpful. I mean, the way I defined it, we are not currently a post-human because, by my definition, you would have to have a being that had capabilities that vastly exceeded those that any current human could have without access to new technology. So it sort of makes, by definition, it's the case that we are not post-humans. Now, you might say that indexing to some earlier human, that we would have various capabilities. In their light, we might be post-human. And And that might be the case. I mean, it's not clear that with regard to basic biological capacities, we are that different from our hunter-gatherer ancestors. But even if it were, it would have been made irrelevant by stipulation. Because what we're basically interested in, I mean, you might be interested in different things. You might be interested in how far have we come in the last 10,000 years. But if you're interested in what will happen in the future, then the question is, how big will the difference be from what we are now? But it is a point that is often made, and I mean, you can sort of field test some arguments against transhumanism by thinking, what if sort of the caveman had heard the same argument when they were sitting around the campfire, or even our humanoid ancestors, they were saying, should we evolve to be human, you know? And a lot of the arguments that now are trying to show that we should not become post-human would have applied equally to them in that situation, to say that they should not become human.
I was very interested in your last point that you closed your speech on. And I guess the question is, as technology progresses and advances, do you think there's certain moral absolutes, I guess, in terms of areas of technology that we should need to pursue as humans, and why not?
Well, I mean, I think there might be areas of technology that we would be better off not pursuing. Not necessarily because of any fundamental moral principle, but because of what the practical implications are likely to be. So, take some very dangerous forms of, there might be technologies that would make it a lot easier to manufacture biological warfare agents. And so you have, for example, the possibility of DNA synthesis machines that exist now gradually becoming more capable by the year. These are machines that take as input some chemicals and a digital blueprint of a genome, and they output actual DNA. So you can use this to print out DNA. You also have in the public domain, accessible on the internet, the genomes of various very lethal pathogens, including smallpox, 1918 flu, Ebola, etc. And so far, these viruses are a little bit too complex to be simply manufactured by the DNA synthesis machines today. You can't synthesize; they have been synthesized from scratch, but it takes like a team effort by a proper research lab. But in 10, 15 years' time, anybody who buys one of these DNA synthesis machines will be able to print out their own smallpox, unless something is done to prevent this. So there is an example of a technology. It's an extreme case where it seems clear we would be better off without it. But it's not because of some specific basic moral principle that says thou shalt not build DNA synthesis machines. It's because the way that this machine would likely be used. So I think it's very difficult to, aside from these extreme cases, it's very difficult to assess the good or bad of particular technologies, outside a particular social, situation. I think one needs to make a case-by-case assessment, looking not so much at how basic moral theories would apply, but at what the practical implications are likely to be. Let's see, I think you might have been next, and then here.
Okay. After. How are we to define the size of the different modes of being? I mean, you mentioned transhumanism, we might be able to expand our current conception of what it is, the human being. And it looks like the current conception is so small that there's just these large possibilities. How do we define those possibilities, or how did you define how big the sphere is?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really a schematic, so there is no axis here that defines a particular metric. But in an intuitive sense, you might think that the difference between people in this room and a starving farmer in Africa 5,000 years ago is bigger than the average difference between two people in this room, say. Because we are all sort of well-fed, sitting in contemporary America in an academic institution, but the difference between you and the farmer 5,000 years ago is huge, intuitively. I don't have a metric for that, but there is a kind of intuitive sense of
the size of the differences. And the difference between you and the farmer in Africa is small relative to the difference between you and, you know, a kangaroo. Because you and the farmer still have the same mental architecture. You can both feel fear and hate and love and, you know, think about, you can, the bat is very different. And similarly, so one could extend this to even more bizarre and alien forms of existence. But it's not a precise quantitative notion. I think you were next.
Yeah, I just extension to what was asked earlier. So in absence of any moral absolutes, how would you regulate, like, you know, what sort of enhancement should occur and not occur? I know the simple answer is that, you know, being moral beings, we could self-regulate ourselves, or is it a team effort that we regulate what sort of enhancements are okay for the society or not? So who would take care of that part?
I guess there are a couple of different questions in there. So one is the procedural question, is what, like, how do you deal with the fact that different people have different views? You know, through what mechanism should there be a decision made? Should individuals make their own decisions? Should the government make a decision? Should the UN? I mean, what's the... And I'm not sure that there is a simple answer there. I mean, I would... acknowledge that, although I'm not sure it's an essential part of the definition, but in practice, transhumanists have tended to place a lot of emphasis on individual choice, society should make available different options, perhaps check them for safety, and perhaps there are some that are so extreme that they would have to be banned, but within broad parameters, leave this to, you know, adults to make choices for themselves, competent adults. And to parents to make choices for their children. And then there might be some limitations on that. We require everybody to go to school. We don't leave that to the choice to parents as to whether the child should have an education or not. No, maybe if cognitive enhancements were really effective, there would be a similar case, an analogous, that would be too important to give people the right to opt out for their children. And that, I'm not sure. That, I mean, you could go either way on that. So allocating, putting a lot of the choices in the domain of the competent individuals and then parents for the children, I think would be the default assumptions for a lot of transhumanists. That's not so much derived from first principles. I think it's... Why do transhumanists think this? Well, I guess there's a mixture of different things. I mean, one is the sad track record of attempts to socially engineer better humanity, if we look to the past, the whole eugenics movement and all the atrocities done there. It certainly seems very dangerous to have one central agency deciding one mold, that all humans should be made in that mold. If that turns out to be a bad mold, then we're all doomed, as it were. If there's some variety, that seems safer. Plus, there would be a lot less. A lot of ideologies would place value on self-determination and respecting individual autonomy, and obviously relegating choices to individuals would do that, while imposing one solution or one pattern from above on everybody would violate individual rights at a massive level. Plus, there are very specific rights that are already enshrined. We think we have, the right, the reproductive rights to decide who we have children with, when or not to have it, whether to have a tattoo or not. We have the right to refuse medical treatments. All of that fits also better in to the framework where a lot of these choices are made by individuals rather than imposed by some appointed designer.
That one of the reasons you have that divide is largely because of terminology, at least in public opinion, especially with words like post-human. So I'm just wondering if you think there is a way to move past and use different terminology, and if so, vocabulary you would see being used in this case.
Yeah. I think that at least in these two phases, that it's not just that there was a word that some people didn't like. I think there was a whole cluster of opinions that tended to go together. So you would have one view on, if you were against cognitive enhancements, you would probably also be against extension of the human lifespan through artificial means beyond living out the normal human lifespan. You would probably also be against, you know, sports doping. You would be against a whole host of things. And these tended to cluster. So in theory, you could have a person who was strongly in favor of cognitive enhancement and strongly against life extension, say. But in practice, you found one group of people who tended to be bioconservatives and another group that was much more transhumanist. So I think that as a caricature of history, there really was a kind of polarity there. In terms of vocabulary going forward, I think that the best thing would be to talk specifically about whatever the interventions are. So if you are thinking about, now, if there is a drug, modafinil, and you think there should be more research into what its effects are, or development into develop better memory enhancers, then I think you should say just that, rather than go indirectly via some big complicated terminology about post-humans and then back down again. So speaking more specifically about each thing you mentioned would be some way to overcome this. And also with, so there's a big difference, you take cognitive enhancement again, like if you're speaking about some pharmaceutical that might give you a 10% or 20% improvement in some mental capacity, it's a totally different thing from if you're talking about artificial intelligences surpassing humans and sort of, and both of these might be important things to discuss and a lot of interesting issues around them, but it's not necessarily helpful to lump them into the same conceptual category. Some questions over here.
Another argument of the bioconservatives is the slippery slope argument that if you start something, it might seem good, but then you'll just keep going in that direction and it could be get out of control. And given some of the problematic components you mentioned about transhumanism, like sort of underestimating the bad effects of the medical side effects, or sort of like techno-hype, just being excited about a lot of different technology, how might a transhumanist deal with this slippery slope argument again?
Well, I mean, the transhumanist, in a sense, would like there to be a slippery slope if, you know, what's at the end is a nice pool of warm water that you're going to... I mean, if you like what's at the other side, you want any step that facilitates further step would be a good thing. So it's really only if you think that the destination is bad that you would worry about the slippery slope.
Right, but there are problematic components of the transhumanist. If someone who's aware of those problematic components, how would they...
Yeah, well, it's a good question. So, I think it becomes a very, so if for example you're the bad component, pick one. So say, I don't know, the existential risk interaction, or is there some other? It might be easier to.
I can't come up with anything.
The virus example.
Right. So the virus example. So one question there would be, should one favor, you know, progress in. Well, so there are different questions you could ask. One is, should we work on designing more dangerous pathogens? And most people would say, no, that's a bad idea. And in fact, there is a convention prohibiting that, that nations have agreed to. Then you could ask a slightly different question is, should we proceed with, you know, synthetic biology? You could ask a wider question, you know, what about genetic research in general? What about biology in general? What about science? And you might get a different answer depending on exactly what the question is that you're looking for. It is remarkable, quite independently from transhumanism, just how broad the consensus seemed to be that science is good and that knowledge and understanding is good. You know, people criticize schools because they don't teach children, not because they do teach children. There are very few people who think that we would be better off in general if we were less able to, you know, understand the world. And I think maybe that's ultimately the correct answer, but it's not as obvious as people might think. If there are all these big existential risks ahead of us, then, you know, all these things that reduce government waste and make universities run more effectively and teachers that are more engaging in the classroom, all of that might be contributing to accelerating, you know, our vehicle in a direction where it will ultimately
come to a dismal end.
How about prolonging life and then taxing, and by doing that, taxing the limits of the planet, its resources?
Yeah, so that's the like the overpopulation problem. Well, I mean, there would be a number of answers traditionally that would be brought up at this point. So one is that if the choice is between reducing the number of the rate at which new people come into the world and forcing people to die by withholding life-saving treatment, then the morally better choice would be to, you know, reduce the number of new births. You might perhaps give people a choice that either you only have, you know, one child per century or whatever the rate might be, or if you want to have more children, then you have to forego life extension treatments. There would be various options that would be superior to, say, you know, denying everybody this capability. I mean, and that also, I mean, in the long run, you might think that the carrying capacity would be increased by either new technologies or space colonization, etc.
So I want to push a question that I think has been coming up in a few different ways about either about drawing a line between human and post-human or the value of framing arguments for against enhancements, particularly those in favor of human enhancement in terms of post-humanism. So here are two strands sort of the just argue for enhancement. Talking about transhuman, post-human is unhelpful and, if anything, counterproductive to getting people on the side of enhancement. The first is to look at that timeline and to say, actually, these debates are much, much older. The first, arguably, counter-transhumanist work, I don't even know the first, but you could say it's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, right? Or a new Prometheus, someone who Prometheus created man in the Greek myth, Frankenstein created a new super trans man, and it turns out so badly that when people have sort of knee-jerk counter-reactions to doomsday scenarios of new technology, we still call them Frankenstein cases,
right?
Although it's also a social critique, you could think of H.G. Wells' Time Machine as well. The reason I bring up what goes farther back is and there's also, or you could say you could look at Zarathustra and Nietzsche about, you know, a human being that can overcome certain limitations of a bad moral code and other things that we have. I bring that up that it goes farther back to suggest that actually it has just been the same kind of debate. That is, you could say before there were people against transhumanism, there were people against humanism. I don't know how much, at the end of the day, I don't really see very much difference between what Leon Kass really, what I think he really thinks, and don't eat from the tree of the fruit of knowledge of good and evil, or don't steal fire from the gods, know your place. That is, and there are people who want to say, yes, we're human beings, let's do the best for ourselves, let's learn, let's advance people.
Right.
And then you have people who say, the senses are reasons of the devil, and seeking wealth and material well-being and prosperity are bad. All that's playing God, and God wants us in a lowly position. So the contrary is, well, let's keep advancing. Let's keep doing that. Let's embrace the best we can have in our condition. I mean, it seems to be something that whether or not that changes our top IQ a few points or not is the same aspiration, and the those who wish to see that undone have the same negative.
Yeah, well, I mean, so transhumanism is an outgrowth of humanism, rational humanism.
Yeah.
That's clearly its historical antecedents and its roots. And there are precursors. I mean, I think a lot of the examples one could point to of seeming discourse about human enhancement before this time. I mean, there are exceptions. Most of that was not really about human enhancement, but it was using that as a kind of projection screen to display scenarios, which could then be used to discuss other things like various contemporary social problems and so forth. A lot of futurology does still serve that function. It's not really about the future, it's about the present, and you can paint the future and then you can use that to critique the present. I think that actually specifically focusing on the use of technology to enhance human biological capacities is a surprisingly recent theme. And there are still humanists around, like who call themselves and have humanist societies and associations and stuff. And not all of those are on board with transhumanism. They had in mind, you know, better education for all, better nutrients, democracy, and then these kind of traditional ways of ameliorating the human condition. And it seems to be an extra step to think that you should directly apply science and technology to change biological human nature.
Sorry, I want to let one more person ask a question, and we're going to have to wrap up, but I do want to point out that you'll have two more shots at Vic tomorrow over on the neuroscience side of Penn, a lunch talk at noon, and another talk in the afternoon. And I believe the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience website has the information on where all that's taking place. So can we have one last question?
Yeah.
So if you, maybe just to sum up, if you were to fantasize as to what that warm bath would look like for your great-great-grandchildren, what do you think about? Maybe not your great-great-grandchildren, but some generation from now.
Oh, we don't know when that would be.
Right, but what do you think about?
Well, I think about... I have a short little essay. It's called Letter from Utopia. It's on my website, which is a feeble attempt, but the best I could do to try to, in a sort of more evocative language, convey some sense of what that might be like.
Consider that an assignment. Well, thanks very much.
I have to kind of draw on that. The other thing I want to ask is about the kind of sense of the state space that there are certain ways
where
I think
or is there like really doing a lot of like kinetic?
Is a deer better off in a human state of life? To what sense does that make? Right? If it has to be in a human state of life, this goes to I can see that that's
seen
that.
You read that more against
that. No, I get that one. Right next to it.
Extra-protonism.
It's a term that
higher
than gene therapy. Well,
Don't you defeat them better by reshaping the field of clay?
I don't know, maybe in rhetorical.
I mean, or in the long run, that is to say, you know, when you, that is if you can, if you can make it so that people see a distinction between these things. If you think there's a moral, there isn't any morally salient difference, or even maybe conceptually salient difference in different sorts of enhancement, then I would say, try to reform the concept so this doesn't seem like a difference anymore. And then the it's a sort of uphill battle for them. I suppose then it comes down to, I have a suspicion that at least the most conservative, if they had their brothers, they wouldn't stop where they stopped. They have to also be at a certain place where people are publicly in favor of this and that. And they can't go sort of too far anti-humanistic approaches. But I mean, in a different time, in a different place, the same impulses that ended up to be this new drive or that new thing, they would have been against the printing press. The young cast would have been against anesthesia, and you would have been against the printing press. Yeah, right. All right, we'll talk way back.
Like, is this going to be like an evolution thing? Over time, like people, it takes like generations of like people living like really crappy lives to realize like, oh, we need that actually. You know, because otherwise, I mean, the question of like, a good life, like nobody. Right, that's the real question.
I was wondering, how much technology does it take to become post-human? And I'm thinking of Michael Phelps, because he used technologies to build muscles that was never used. And then he had technologically advanced like electrolytes that he was drinking before his games, and he wore technology that was like removable. But like when he wore the suit, he was able to swim faster than any race ever imagined and got 8 gold medals. So like, is he post-human in that
So technically, in the terms of the definition, swimming would not be a general sample capacity, it would be a specific capacity, like the ability to swim.
So to be post-human, it would have to be generally...
Not just better at some specific thing. But better at some very general thing, like staying alive, or thinking, or you know, having
Like as an emerging bioethicist, and when I'm on an IRB, do you think in my lifetime I'll see scientists coming up with ideas to create this post-human state, like in my lifetime? Or is this something I don't really have to worry about?
I think that nobody really knows. I mean, certainly they will come up with ideas. I mean, already there are ideas in the sense of.
And do we have a responsibility to like entertain that idea?
Ideas have to be judged individually on their merits. So some people will come up with dumb ideas, and others, if there's a good idea, then if your job is to think, then you know, you might want to pay attention to it. But I think the time scales are very difficult to predict. I mean, I actually think that it's fairly likely that rather than having more and more powerful biotechnologies that give us pass in your lifespan and cognitive enhancement, and we become post-human in that way. I think perhaps a more likely scenario is very different, which is that at some first stage, like slow, gradual progress, incremental, like we have now, but for another 20, 30 years, little things. And then maybe somebody discovers artificial general intelligence, like machine superintelligence, or something. And then that might then quickly invent all sorts of other technology. But that there might be this kind of abrupt scenario. It might be more possible than, I mean, either, it's hard to know either, but. I don't necessarily see that there would be hundreds of years of slow build-up of biological capacity and that that would necessarily be the cutting edge of the thing.
Does anybody put themselves in a...
What's your background?
Well, I got them different. I did physics and computational neuroscience and philosophy as well, and mathematics.
Whoa, that's cool.
Cool. Wow.
All right, thank you.
Just looking at maybe extension of life and the adaptations you said that we might have to put into our society in order to accommodate that. So it seems like we're already going
to break down,
even though we're not calling it transhumanism.
I felt the way you did until I stepped back and looked at
it. Got to pick up.
Which society has brought about
the everything, you know, it's dangerous. Thank you.
Thank you so much.